Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. May I, first of all, just say who I am? My name is John Berg, which is not important. What is important is that I'm one of the group of six who founded and endowed this lecture, this annual lecture, about the Good Society. All of us, originally seven, came to VLSE after the war, and were here from 1946 in six cases, to 1949, in the seventh, in my case, because I was backward, I stayed here till 1950. And since then, the seven of us have met every year without exception, and many of the seven have met much more frequently than that. And we founded this lecture in memory of the seventh, who unfortunately died in 1989, Oliver Marston, but also to express our debt to the LSE. This is something all of us feel keenly, because we were here after the war, and we were concerned in our then, no doubt, relatively immature, but perhaps slightly more effective, way with the Good Society. Maybe some of you saw the Peter Hennessy program on Channel 4 on Sunday, which gave a very good illustration of how, despite the post-war privations, so many of us felt members of a community and felt that this was a good society which we were then helping to build. Today's lecture is the third lecture in this series. The first was given by Ralf Dahrendorf, extremely appropriately as a former director of the school. The second was given last year by Prime Minister Gro Brundtland of Norway, who today, fortunately or unfortunately, is probably otherwise engaged. And the third lecture will be given tonight by Bishop Jenkins. From the outset, when we discussed the foundation of this lecture, we decided that the subject of the Good Society should be considered from different perspectives. And no one could be a more appropriate lecturer for the Good Society than someone who has been so concerned with ethical, moral, and spiritual values in our society. Bishop Jenkins is truly one of the most distinguished churchmen of our age. He's noted both as a theologian and as a bishop with profound pastoral experience and a deep concern for the underprivileged. And we are delighted to welcome him today, Bishop Jenkins.
Thank you very much indeed, Sir John. with such an introduction, of course, one is filled with alarm, if not despondency, not least because I suspect, if I have been careful, God is not mentioned in this lecture except in a quotation from John Locke. So, goodness, goods, and the disappearance of the common good was my title when I received this invitation. And of course the invitation to give the third of these memorial lectures has greatly honoured and challenged me. But the actual attempt to prepare the lecture has confronted me with the reality of being in my 70th year and with the strong probability that I am at least verging on the obsolescent, if not actually obsolete. For the very idea of giving an annual series of lectures on the Good Society in 1994 seems, does it not, to be a hangover from the post-war optimism which was around, as Sir John has already explained, when the members of the 1949 seminar who founded this lecture series were, like myself, at their university studies after service in the armed forces in at least the concluding stage, of which we oldies still refer to quite simply as the war. And at that time, it was very widely taken for granted that the common purpose which we had all shared when we were being organized to fight the war would carry over into the future. We had been united in fighting what we were clear was an evil society, with the purpose of keeping open our own opportunities to maintain and develop a good society. And this would now be carried forward in times of peace. And you will remember, either from history or from knowledge, though as I have thought on and on as I've been writing this, of course, I mean, to have remembered what the fuss was actually about when the Beveridge Report was published and when we went into the first general election after the war around those sort of issues, one would presumably, on the assumption that one didn't take much of an interest in these things, at least until one was 15, one would have to be 67 to 70 anyway, you see, hence these feelings of general obsolescence and so on. But we were focusing on this common commitment, which were particularly influenced by the proposals in this Beveridge report, which you must remember, and I think it's relevant, was actually published in 1942. That is to say, at a time when, although as some commentators say, defeat seemed unlikely, victory was by no means obvious. And there was something going on which made people already look forward. The object of the Beveridge Report was to deal with the basic problems of poverty, sickness, unemployment, and old age. And I well remember myself, my wife is in the audience, so I'd better be careful what I say, that when, having recently come out of the war and being an impoverished undergraduate, I thought it highly desirable that she should marry me if she would agree, one of the things which actually counted with me was that having been brought up to suppose you had to provide for your wife, I was much comforted by the thought that we at least got as far as the National Health Service, and therefore if she were to become sick, she could be looked after, even if I went on being as poverty-stricken as I then was. Of course, I made it worse by becoming a clergyman. But I put it that way to indicate that, I mean, these things were very personal and individual and direct, a theme which I want really to pursue through all the rather tedious arguments of this lecture. The whole approach, I think, was under the aim of enabling everyone to know that they, rather we, are citizens together, with a basic stake in our good society. And this society would be good to us and good for us in at least providing some basic provisions against the risks of ill health, of unemployment and poverty, especially in old age, and would support a standard of living which was at least above the misery level. And there was, I think, a genuine feeling of being all citizens with a basic stake in the society which we were hoping to build. And just to focus our minds and imaginations for the arguments I wish to develop, I do propose shortly to quote from the chapter entitled War and Welfare in the 1940s from The Evolution of the British Welfare State by Derek Fraser of the University of Bradford, which was first published in 1973. And to pick up this matter of obsolescence and so on, I do not think that it is just an example of nostalgia on the part of the elderly as they, or of course, as I should say, we. But of course, as Bernard Baruch said, if you ask me who's elderly, the answer is anybody who's 10 years older than I am. But that I do not think it is a matter of nostalgia on the part of the elderly that we should want to go back to these sort of things, because I believe that an accurate evocation of the prevailing feel, as you might say, in this country in the years immediately after the war is of great importance. As I say, this is only, in one sense, the nostalgic evocation of elderly gentlemen. But there is also a strong and urgent case, I believe, to be made for contributing from elderly experience and recollection to encourage a revival of historical imagination among all ages in our currently depressed, fragmented, and what I should call quarrelsomely nitpicking society. It's not a question of hiding away from the paces and pressures of the present by recalling past enthusiasms and hopes of as doses of, shall we say, drug-like anaesthetic nostalgia. I think that's more likely to come from the various devices of virtual realism, but one could discuss that elsewhere some other time. But that just shows how obsolescent I am, you see. Rather, it is reminding people of past hopes, visions and dreams which can help to kindle the shared enthusiasms and aspirations and efforts for the future. Must we abandon hopes and visions of a better society? In his interpretation given in the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, of the events which are traditionally held to be the founding of the Christian Church by the descent of the Spirit, the Apostle Peter makes use of a saying from the prophet Joel, "I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams." I increasingly have the impression that there are more and more people around who are wondering whether there are sources of imagination and inspiration available which could rekindle shared visions of, sustainable hopes for, and sufficiently common actions towards a good society. And I am not sure that this is just an impression. In my 10 years as a bishop, which have in some ways driven me nearer to atheism than anything else in my life, but that's incidental, I have received literally tens of thousands of letters. And a great many of those letters express something like a longing for actually rekindling some notion of common value, common pursuit, common community. Now, it's easy to make rude remarks about the word community, especially when used by Labour leaders seeking to assert their authority. But it expresses some sort of longing. There is a need, I think, for envisioning and then working out ways of applying shared human and social activities, organisations and celebrations of shared living together, which rescue us from the desperately unimaginative and threateningly boring approach to life which sees relationships in terms of monetary transactions. I well remember a splendid song in the Cambridge Footlights, although that I was at the other place, by one Simon Phipps, who eventually himself became a bishop, about original sin, in which he had a splendid lyric about all seven of them, and ended up by saying, "I've tried them all, and they're so boring." And this is one of the features of our present approach to life and its values, it seems to me, which needs to be fought against. This whole business of understanding accountability in terms of accounting in balance sheets with short-term bottom lines, this whole business of reducing being a citizen into being a customer, even on trains I get furious when I'm just as a customer, I want to travel. And I suspect, I'm quite sure, if I were ill, I wouldn't mind being a patient. And to respond to this sort of thing with consumers' charters of trivial content and doubtful enforcement, I think is not only inefficient, but boring. And finally, we even have the only real hope of changing things in terms of a large win in a lottery. There might therefore be some contribution to be made to raising our sights, enlarging our hopes, and increasing our enjoyments of life together by old men once again dreaming dreams which revive the hopes and aspirations which they had when they were young men seeing visions. At least the question could be examined as to whether Mark Twain was right when he wrote, "The man who is a pessimist before 48 knows too much. If he is an optimist after it, he knows too little." Consider, therefore, the following extracts from this rather humdrum account of a period of optimism about doing something together in an organized way, about improving things in our common life, and so moving things to some extent in the direction of a shaping of a good society. This is one or two extracts from the chapter on war and welfare in the 1940s. "If the essential theme of the 1930s had been selectivity, that of the 1940s was universalism. Plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. The whole business of trying to do things for everybody, and then we can't afford it, and we go back to selectivism." And then I can't help avoid quoting this bit, because I think, again, it is so echoing, resonant for our time, that specious universalism, which in 1931 had required the unemployed to share in the national sacrifice by a 10% cut in income, did not hide the fact that society and social policy were riddled with arbitrary distinctions and selective treatment. You can say that again. And we must all share sacrifices. Well, I'll come to that in a minute. The war was to have decisive influence in producing a common experience and universal treatment for it. It did, in fact, generate the political and social determination to overcome enormous difficulties, and in its wake, the spirit and practice of universalism affected the course of social policy. And much of what might be termed the spin-off effects on social policy resulted from the nature of the Second World War as a total war. And he goes on to say how this bringing together in the war effort produced a growing concern for the health and welfare of an ever-widening circle of people, and therefore there was a determination to do it. And further, this was underlined by the shock of the experience of evacuation, people being picked up from the inner cities and dumped in the respectable areas of the country. Evacuation was part of the process by which British society came to know itself. Came to know itself, an interesting phrase about everybody responding alike to these revelations, which is certainly not the case at the moment, by which British society came to know itself as the unkempt, ill-clothed, undernourished, and often incontinent children of bomb cities, acting as messengers, carrying the evidence of the deprivation of urban working-class life into rural homes. Evacuation, which aroused the national social conscience in the very first year of war, became, as one writer put it, the most important subject in the social history of the war, because it revealed to the whole people the black spots in its social life. An interesting reflection there of a sense of commitment, a sense of shock, and a sense of readiness to try and do something about it. And I would say that this account does rightly reflect what it felt like. After the 1939-45 war, there was a strong sense of belonging together. Of course, this didn't really work once the disciplines and the comparatively simple aims of war organization was slackened, but there was an accompanying sense of mutual responsibility, with recognition not only of the need for, but of the possibilities of mutual support through taxation and organisation, and therefore a political will to do something about moving our society as a whole, picking up the universalist notion, in the envisioned and desired direction. But of course we all know it didn't work. There were many stresses, strains and hidden snags internal to the enterprise of the welfare state. There came the economic difficulties which developed in the early 70s, so the time was ripe then to crown the growing discovery that the enterprise of the welfare state was not working and probably couldn't be financed by the establishment of a theory that it should not work and indeed must not be attempted. I think it interesting, in fact, that in its preparation for the budget, The Guardian, in an article this morning, quotes Geoffrey Howe when he introduced what might be called the first of the definitely Thatcherite budgets in June 1979. He said, "There is a definite limit to our capacity as politicians to influence things for the better." Of course, it's all very well doing that, but then you have to reckon, as I shall say, as my main thesis in this argument, does that mean that you have to go on influencing things for the worse? However, the definite limitation to influence things for the better. The notions of demand management, expanding public spending, and fine-tuning of the economy have now been tested to destruction, and so we must change. And that is, it is this watershed which we have gone over, which is one of the challenging things to those of us who are still concerned with hopes of working for a good society. So we have to pay attention to the reasons why corporate activity, organized and implemented by the state to alter and arrange social relationships and conditions in society, are now held to be positively bad. and that these reasons are held to be to do with the nature of social organization in the world and with the basic central issue of the freedom of human beings. The proponents of this approach to the world and to life and politics in it and to the role of freedom in human life have a very clear view of the good society, it seems to me. The good society is the society where there is the minimum interference with the free choices of each and every individual and the maximum openness to the uninterrupted and undisturbed free activities of the market. It so happens as is alleged to be inevitable, but by an amazing piece of luck, of course, because only it couldn't be, it would have to be by chance because there's nothing ruling the world, it is also good for us, or at least good for those of us who say that it is good. So, this is the argument. And the arguments which make up this approach are well known. Friedrich Hayek, for instance, sets them out with powerful and persuasive clarity. It's the question of the realities which are involved in that extended order which has grown up through the productive and trading activities of the human race from an early stage in their history as they developed into the civilized and civilizing order we now have. And the fundamental issue in understanding this extended order in relation to the moral, local, and face-to-face activities of human beings is simply one of scale. One of scale. The values of moral face-to-faceness and of what we might call local civics, people caring for one another in a neighborly way, are simply and clearly not capable of application or appropriate in the extended order of complex, large-scale societies and markets. As Hayek pointed out, in order, of course, to indicate the irrelevance of Western traditions of civics and politics drawn largely from Aristotle to our complex trading and technological world, Aristotle himself held that a viable city stretched as far as the herald's cry. A viable city stretched as far as the herald's cry. Human and intimate communication and caring can stretch effectively no further. David Hume had already tumbled to this as part of leading up to Adam Smith and then on to our modern theoreticians. So noble affection as generosity, he writes, instead of fitting men for large societies, is almost as contrary to them as the most narrow selfishness. And before one can ignore such a sentence and observation, I for one have to consider things which I have been involved in my dealings with the medical profession, for instance, that the whole fuss over the managerial observations of the businessman chairman of a hospital trust, that the doctor's orders of responsibility ought to be one, the trust, two, the team, and three, the patients. Outrage all round. But it is the case that clinical independence, which concentrates a great deal of time and other resources on a particular patient, bears costs. Costs including the depriving of other patients of, what shall we say, their fair share or their chance of treatment and time. I don't, in the end, sympathize with what might be called the spirit of the point, the way the point was put, but it's not an easy one. It's all very well being generous if you're being generous at the expense of other people and so on. There is a very real question here, and so it is argued that in the extended order, it cannot be neighborliness, caring, and justice that counts, but the market, which is that extended order which provides the means of survival, growth in goods, freedom of choice, and the means of extending the freedom of individuals to fulfill their wants. Hayek writes, David Hume saw that the market made it possible to do a service to another without bearing him a real kindness or even knowing him, or to act to the advantage of the public, though it is not intended for that purpose by another. By this order, in which the interest, it was in the interest, even of a bad man, to act for the public good. Attempts to organize morally guided intervention in this order cannot improve the human lot, only impede the means of providing the material resources for doing the best open to us about the human lot, both our own and the collective one, insofar as it exists. And all this has been made clear enough now by the total collapse of the socialist East. Of course, this business, the interest even of a bad man to act for the public good, is a clear echo of what will come from Adam Smith about not from the benevolence of the butcher and the baker, etc., but from their interest that we get our means of living. The evolutionary processes of human culture have become focused around that amazing explosion of trading, specialization, and credit, which has resourced such widespread developments in material resources, and thus in the resources available for civilization, culture, and the general expansion of the material and spiritual goods of life. Further, what the market responds to, what indeed operates the market, is the choices of individual human beings in a multiplicity of situations and with a multiplicity of perspectives, desires, ideals, and hopes, which couldn't possibly be coordinated in any other way. Indeed, to attempt to coordinate in any other way, most notably by the intervention and action of the state, guided or in fact misguided by some threatened and imposed, theoretical and imposed policy, is the supreme act of interference and intervention. The market and liberal democracy and personal freedom belong inseparably together. The freedom of the market and the freedom of choice are both practically and morally inescapable. So the attempt to promote any shared and authoritatively conceived common good by either government action or even government encouragement is to let loose both tyranny, the individual grossly coerced into the interests of an ideological fantasy, and devastating waste and inefficiency. Once again, the total collapse of the communist East with the revelations of appalling inefficiency have proved this beyond a peradventure. So we must be clear that any longings for corporate and community activities at the level of the extended order is dangerous and irrelevant nostalgia. Nostalgia about a will-o'-the-wisp fed by our inveterate human tendency to long for the primitive cosiness of the tribal cave and life entirely determined by face-to-face and mutually supportive relationships. As Hayek puts it, it is a craving for a micro-order determined by the overview of an omniscient authority. Love your neighbour as yourself, and the Lord your God with all your heart and your mind, and you will be happy, if not here, at any rate hereafter. But we have, with great liberation and almost incredible multiplication of resources, grown right out of caves and tribes and gods. The interaction of individual human beings at the face-to-face and local and micro level are one thing. The interactions of the extended order of global markets and global communications connected therewith is something categorically and ineradicably other. Each of us as a self and as a member of a family or a group have to make the best we can of the interaction of the two levels or distinct spheres. Idealism about such interactions is both useless and dangerous. In fact, a primitive superstition. And there is a further disturbing and depressing footnote. Supposing one did actually hang on to the belief that there was a need and there were some possible resources for promoting some sort of purposive collective effort to rally people in some way or other, to, shall we say, get beyond the market, or find a common vision of how to construct and maintain space within the market order for more human and humane common efforts for common good. Where would you draw your values, common visions, inspirations, and common directions from? The world, especially in the West, but almost completely now, is now too full of pluralism in cultures, religions, and philosophies, both between and within cultures. We may compare all the arguments that go on, all the way from the ultra-traditionalists, who retire into a false vision of the past in order to avoid an unpleasant experience of the present, to the ultra-deconstructionalists, who tell us it couldn't make any sense anyway, so give up trying, although they try to persuade us we should give up trying. So, there isn't a hope in hell of common responses to our variously perceived plights and possibilities. We have to face, therefore, the apparent impossibility of the emergence of some authoritatively and effectively shared values about living together. And I might just slip in here, especially as I'm a bishop, given what we've found out about crusades and ideologies, might not an attempt to crusade for common good be a cure even worse than the disease? Consider on the one hand the tyrannies of ideologies, and also what happens when religious people become totally persuaded that their view of truth is not only true, but only essential and total. There is, of course, hell to pay by people who think they're going to heaven. Perhaps we are therefore forced to the conclusion that attempts to revive pursuit of the common good are simply nostalgic dreams after all, about the will-o'-the-wisp and the inveterate arising from the inveterate and primitive human tendency to long for tribal cosiness. We had better grow up and get on as best we may, whoever we may happen to be, even if we are six wise men who shared a wartime experience, joined by a seventh who's been stupid enough to become a bishop. Where can we go from here? Accept the inevitable procedures and processes of the market, and this will be simply accepting the universe. But this surely is a counsel of despair. A counsel of despair, moreover, which is somehow very trivializing of a whole strand at the heart of human life and traditions, whereby even if despair is seen to be the appropriate response to the human predicament, as human beings come to perceive it at any particular historical juncture, then it is necessary, appropriate, open, and somehow inevitable to rage at despair. And to pick up my trivial example before, the trouble with so much of these citizen charters and so on is not that they are obviously ineffective political gimmicks, but they trivialize the business and dimensions of human living together in a way which is surely beyond belief and beyond endurance, if even you have to put up with it. One of the things I discovered when being used as the guru for prison chaplains over 3 years, and when I was significantly asked to talk to them originally about the faith to face failure, was that the one thing you must never do is tolerate the intolerable, although you have to put up with it. Because if you tolerate the intolerable, the way you put up with it gets more and more intolerable. I hope you follow that obvious point. You see how it is possible to discover hope by simple humour. And what we have come to do, I believe, is in grave danger of tolerating the intolerable just because we think we don't yet know what to do about it. Further, what is so inevitable about it all? As I'm enrolled with the people who've invited me to give this lecture, in this looking back, I recall that in my student days, there was a book by, I think, J.D. Bernal, entitled The Freedom of Necessity. The Freedom of Necessity, which with both clarity of argument and the prestige of a noted scientist, invited us to welcome the necessities of Marxist diagnosis and action as the one and only way to freedom. Are we now to bow down and worship before the freedom of necessity offered us in pamphleteering and articles written about the market? I am inclined to ask, how dumb and how docile can you get? I propose, therefore, to start my investigation again. This is just about time. To start my investigation again from the other end, as it were. That is to say, not to consider issues about the good society, but to consider the case for holding, but possibly in a mood of helplessness and powerlessness to do anything better, we are in the process of producing a bad society, Both in our UK society and globally, we seem to be promoting a growing number of indecencies, indecencies. I use the word indecency deliberately, to link up, perhaps rather pedantically, but I hope pointedly, with the basic notion of decency, as it derives originally from the Latin word and Roman idea of decus. Indeed, in my combination of pedantry and seeking for a simple word to evoke a proper sense of a proper combination of logical analysis, aesthetic awareness, and moral sensibility, I go behind the word decus to its etymological origins in the root of the Greek word doxa, which lies in the Sanskrit word for glory or fame. I will not attempt to vocalize the Sanskrit transliteration, because I can never see how these etymologies work, but that's what the dictionaries say. The decent is that which is fitting for and appropriate to and worthy of the human behaviors, the responses and behaviors of human beings, the responses and behaviors of human beings to themselves, to one another, to the circumstances in which they find themselves, and to the world in which these circumstances are to be lived out. Of course, in practice, and as recorded in dictionaries, the word decent and its negative indecent has many formal and informal uses which are related to culture, convention, and customary and local morality and mores. But I am attempting what I might call the Humpty Dumpty ploy. You may remember, though you may not, because as I discovered when lecturing to first-year students at Leeds, you couldn't really communicate because they couldn't remember either the Bible or Gilbert and Sullivan. So the cultural difficulties are immense. But you may remember that in Alice Through the Looking Glass, Humpty Dumpty suddenly introduced into his conversation with Alice the exclamation, "There's glory for you." When questioned by Alice as to the meaning of the observation, he replied to the effect that he made words mean what he wanted them to mean. Now I want a word which might just possibly focus and recall and reawaken a sense, a shared and shareable sense across a very wide range of cultures, perspectives, experiences, and circumstances of what is fitting for, appropriate to, and worthy of human beings. So I have picked on the word decent with its ancient roots in glory and fame. I want this word, via its negative, to evoke an active and concerned awareness of what we can sense and ought to sense, of what we can judge and ought to judge, and of what we can long for and ought to hope for, as fitting to the celebratory and shareable worth and glory of human beings. In logical terms, the use of the word indecent that I am about to make is to want it to serve as a performatory exclamation, a performatory exclamation. I cannot, so to speak, prove to you the meaning I intend for the word, set it up beyond a peradventure, nor can I fully explain to you what I am inviting you to join with me in meaning by the word. I am asking you to look and see, as part of an extended argument, the outlines of which, of course, I can only sketch in the space of this lecture, that we are in danger of being trapped in a grave failure to look and see that in much we are doing, promoting, and allowing to develop in our local societies and in our global networks, we are abandoning ourselves and our human neighbours to too much that is utterly unworthy and offensive, and that this ought not to be tolerated for any longer than is absolutely necessary. In fact, we are ignoring, tolerating, and promoting indecencies. I'll briefly point to the sort of things I have in mind, and not only have in mind indeed, but I seek to have in what I might call in heart and spirit, for human beings surely are not trapped in or confined to mere logic, however much we have to pay careful and rigorous attention to it. And then I'll take up a logical argument about how our current over-absolutizing of the separate and separated individual, combined with our over-idolizing of the market, inevitably produces, promotes, and seeks to ignore these indecencies. or if you are even more sophisticated about it, to argue that they, as they are inevitable, they are not indecent and outrageous. Just too bad, which means, of course, they are not very bad. The growing number of indecencies is surely obvious and documented daily in reports in the papers, but not surely taken sufficiently seriously. Globally, we may consider, simply for example, our use and abuse of natural resources, both in using them up in a very dangerous way and in cornering markets and monopolising these resources. Examples which are currently around at the moment in the papers are to do with the patenting and therefore procuring a profitable monopoly upon various genetic developments to do with crops and the like. The dangerous farming in intensive ways of carnations in Latin America, the business of grains being dealt with by fertilizers which when sprayed cause all sorts of diseases in the person spraying them and so on in India, and the way in which the natural development of things is taken up by multinational companies and then not only becomes a matter of profit, but of course passes beyond the means of the local people to use them. Or again, the way in which global financial markets seem increasingly to make money out of money, with decreasing relevance to wealth production. I notice in the financial pages of the Times, let alone a vast supplement in the Financial Times, that even the financiers are getting worried about the growing market in derivatives. You sometimes feel that there must be nothing but a house of cards here, almost intuitively, but I think it's more to do with systems. The more systems respond to themselves, surely, the more turbulent they are bound to become, and so on, but that is for matter for further investigation, but I think it's pretty indecent. And the destruction of viable indigenous ways of life with the substitution of poverty-stricken dependence on global markets. The indecency of this comes home very directly when, for instance, a person like myself at a gathering like the Lambeth Conference meets a Ugandan bishop who is now having to deal with the total poverty in his area, whereas once upon a time they produced crops which were well above subsistence. Now they have to produce crops to be sold in the market, which is not quite enough to actually pay off the debts that have already been incurred on the money that has been lent to Uganda, and so on. It's very difficult to see, however essential this is to something or other, that it's anything but indecent. maybe we can do nothing about it. At least, I think, we ought to be ashamed. And, of course, you can go on with many other things like that. Locally, we may consider, for example, what I think may might begin to disappear, namely the indecent fixtures which feature on the front of the Times business section, which are not, of course, pin-ups, but show smartly suited directors smiling happily over increased profits related to sharply reduced employment possibilities. As a matter of fact, this has so upset even the readers of that section that there's been three letters saying this, it ought to come off, including one from Lord Young, who says, of course, he regrets it, but you have to do it. Yes, well, but why grin about it? And so on. There is also the indecent laissez-faire, which allows government ministers to throw responsibility, for example, entirely on for the inability to care for old people in the community, entirely on to bad local financial management, when both funds and regulations come from Whitehall. And when every time the relevant ministers appear on television, they show a blandness which, I mean, is almost indecent in itself, but is indecently related to the use of inadequate statistics to blanket argument. And there is the indecency of maintaining the claim that prison works in the face of the informed and researched evidence that it doesn't. I'm always wondering when, in order to make it work, the Home Secretary will introduce death houses on the way out so that people are not let out. Otherwise, if you don't try and reform them, what are you going to do with them? They'll come back. Just seems stupid as well as indecent. And our building prisons when we are running down hospitals. You also get, of course, and that's obvious now, isn't it, the gross inflation of directors' salaries in relation to sharp wage restraint and unemployment, combined with putting up costs to those who are most vulnerable. British Gas is the latest example of this. And that, I think, ties in with a wider point which John Galbraith has been making over the years, which I don't quite know how we cope with, but which surely ought to be faced up to, which in his little book about Nearly Everyone's Guide to Economics in 1978, he said that an alternative solution which we need must recognize that an uncontrolled struggle for more income brings an inflation that defeats some or most of these efforts, and that the traditional methods of control, monetary and fiscal policy, shades of a certain chancellor at a certain budget, either do not work, or work by hurting the least affluent, the least employable, those with least control over their prices and incomes. And the solution accepts that no single group can carry the burden of restraint. It must fairly be distributed among all groups. And in his book just published this year about the world economy since the wars, he ends up his in his last chapter mentioning, among other things, it must be recognized that in no industrial country does the market system provide good or even habitable housing for lower income tenantry. Well, it isn't recognized, is it? Except that it's there. And that leads into the the further point that how difficult it is to relate to these arguments and the things that are going on the very sort of personalized feelings which one has when one is involved with people on the ground. This is reflected in a letter in the Times yesterday from three people to do with Church Action for Poverty and the like on the budget need to safeguard the poor. Sir, attention is needed to ensure that those enduring poverty do not bear the brunt of fiscal constraints in the budget. Research into the effects of 8% VAT on fuel shows that people in poverty have suffered disproportionately, and the implementation of the second phase in April 1995 will be crippling for many thousands of households who are already struggling to pay their bills. And it goes on, and we, meaning the signatories, we also see daily the effects of homelessness and poor housing on family life, and they explain why they think this come about. But what I'm referring to this letter for is to this phrase, we also see daily. Who is aware of what affects whom in what way, especially when they are holding forth on television about inevitable. I am still suffering from a feeling of outrage after I had spoken in the House of Lords in a certain debate, which was to do with making everybody pay a part of their poll tax. And I tried to point out that if you have no money in your pocket, then even 5 or 10% of a small sum, which a noble lord from the side you can imagine had said was a small sum, had on people. And I was condescendingly corrected later in the debate by a senior, very noble lord, who was an ex-government minister of great experience, who explained to me patiently that really things weren't like that and I didn't understand what was going on. As I did not know the procedures of the House, I wasn't able to intervene, which was just as well, because I think I should have said, you are a lot of incompetent and ignorant bloody bastards. Now, of course, that is not the sort of language you can use in their lordship's House. And it may well be not the sort of language one should use in civilized discourse about politics. But I wonder, you see, because there seems such an unawareness of what is actually going on. And do we not do well to become angry? And might it not be prudent to become angry when the screw is being turned and turned and turned and we go on holding civilized discourse? I think one of the problems which I should like to follow up, but I shan't further discuss here, is when does it become reasonable to be unreasonable? And I am deeply troubled by that. And also by the fact that, as you can see, I've nearly lost my papers. However, both the losing of my papers may be, and the point that I have just been raising about personal involvement and anger, we must get back to logical and reasonable arguments. The Chancellor is presenting his budget in a glow of satisfaction about how well the economy is doing, on all the normal indicators, outperforming many of our European partners at present. The problem is, isn't it, that a substantial minority of people in this country are just not doing well, they are faring worse. Having rejected the welfare state, we now produce and increase the bad-faring areas. Across the world, there are very many countries and regions where the majority are, in fact, doing worse. And it might be desirable to put on the New Year calendar for all ministers a cartoon from our local Northern Echo, which showed a gentleman with another gentleman, both very scruffy, reading a billboard which says the economy does well. And the caption simply says, "Isn't that good? I wish I belonged to it." Back, you see, to the notion of stakeholders and citizens, in fact. The cause, the response, of course, is growth in the economy and so more employment. Perhaps yes, though, of course, there doesn't seem to be any indication of how there will be anything like enough employment for all the left-outs and forced-outs, especially in my part of the world, but in other parts also. There are also troubling issues about limits to growth and so on, which can't be pursued tonight. But in any case, and this is the point, but in any case, all this will take time if it ever comes off. So, what should we do meanwhile about the left-outs? Surely another indecency of current politics and attitudes seems to be to turn the victims into scapegoats. Victims into scapegoats. The unemployed as a class are lazy, welfare-dependent, welfare fraudsters, and totally unworthy to be citizens. They must be disciplined back to a proper sense of responsibility and stopped whinging about rights. Now, it is, I believe, true that there are no such things as duty-less rights. But how can people be expected to see and accept the disciplines of responsible citizenship if they are constantly excluded, given no chance to develop a sense of belonging, and can read or see daily news of well-to-do people and bosses behaving with immense irresponsibility and making money, for example, beyond the dreams of even the literary jackpot winner, let alone a minor welfare wangler? But there is the further and even more fundamental question of what all these criticisms and all these highlightings of indecencies could lead up to. Should it lead to a proposition that we must look for an alternative to the market as the principal and central means of linking together all the societies of the whole world in their and our pursuit of survival, improvement, and enjoyment? I do not think it can lead to this, and nor need it. Early on in my exploration, when I was summing up the current ideological case for the free market and its essential link with the freedom of the individual choice, I concluded, accepting the inevitable procedures and processes of the market is simply accepting the universe. The central thesis of this lecture, of course, is that such an attitude and argument is trapped in a view, both of the market and of human beings, which is far too narrow and dogmatic. The operations of the market, or rather of markets, and the expectations underlying the market have got trapped in an ideological cul-de-sac. Trapped in an ideological cul-de-sac, constructed by a false view of human beings and their world, which simply lets loose greed as the dominating motive force in human transactions and intercourse. Alas, of course, as I hinted earlier, there is no really original sin, and the seven deadly ones remain as deadly as ever. And this, as this approach, this ideological approach to the market, is linked also with with the view that there must be no restrictions or regulations, and certainly these restrictions and regulations must not be put upon the free choices of individuals in the free market. The results are runaway money-making dominated by individuals or associations that can control huge sums of money and credit. Although through transactions that are increasingly remote from wealth production. These dominating market transactions do not cherish and promote the companies, businesses, and enterprises which contribute to the shared well-being of all their stakeholders. And this is the outworking of simple greed at both the individual and the corporate level. A symptom is, of course, these amazing rewards of directors and executives awarded by other directors who are part of the greed-feeding network. There is no loyalty of a manager or executive to the undertaking he is managing. nor to the stakeholders, who include certainly workers and customers, and often through environmental and other concerns, the public at large. This is not a necessary feature of a good deal of market capitalism. Compare models in Germany and Japan. The only concern is to make and take more money for the individual. Otherwise, move on, and make sure that if you are forced to move on, you are guaranteed a sufficiently large monetary compensation. So finance, industry, and commerce are afflicted by the manipulations of one type of the isolated and separated individual who has no concerns and no loyalties for other than himself. But this is only a type specimen case of the egoistic possessive individual, who has emerged as definitive of the individual whose freedom of choice is supposed to be the moral justification for non-interference in the market. And the logic of the development of this egoistic and isolated individual can be traced through the use made by the uncritical and absolutist promoters of the free market of John Locke's notion of the individual whose primary purpose or basic purpose is survival and whose primary protection is property guaranteed by the justice of the state. Hence the focusing on the individual, his property, and justice as protecting justly acquired property rights and not going any further in any distributive direction, which in fact actually interferes with justice. Locke never approved, or never faced up to the possibilities, if he did entertain the notion, I beg your pardon, Locke never supposed, or never faced up to the possibilities if he did entertain the notion, that individuals would come to be thought of as isolated and egoistical units who were under no restraints but those imposed on their own desires. As Alistair MacIntyre points out in much of his writing, it is a new type of individual has emerged, the individual whose mere wanting is a sufficient reason for doing or getting something. It's not related to what anything else. But Locke took it for granted, for instance, that promises, covenants, and oaths, which are the bond of human society, can have no hold or sanctity for the atheist, for the taking away of God, even if only in thought, dissolves all. There were, he assumed, external and indeed transcendent restraints on the individual pursuit of self-interest defined by the self. Adam Smith rested his economic analysis in The Wealth of Nations on his social analysis in The Theory of Market Sentiments. And as one commentator puts it, Smith held that men could safely be trusted to pursue their own self-interest without undue harm to the community, not only because of the restrictions imposed by law, but also because they were subject to built-in restraint derived from morals, religion, custom, and education. Incidentally, I don't believe that he himself was a great believer in the Hayekian type of extended order. I'm sure he thought, in trying to understand economists from outside economy, it seems to me they all have very simple models. And I am sure that Adam Smith actually thought that exchange was to do with exchanges. That is to say, places where you actually met with people face to face. Compare his remark about monopoly, that people wouldn't get away with it because their colleagues wouldn't let them, which is a face-to-face thing, not an extended order thing. So what he now makes, well, of course, as he doesn't believe in God, he doesn't exist, but the emergence of the competitive and possessive individual, whose values and restraints are entirely internal to him or herself, was not something which Locke or Adam Smith could have imagined, coped with, or approved of. But it is this model of the individual which dominates and justifies the exaltation of freedom of choice in the free market as the essential bedrock for providing both the necessities and the growing delights and luxuries of civilized living. But such individuals are not only dangerous, they are both unnatural and basically impossible. For none of us can even speak and so develop thinking and conscious willing without being, firstly, in total dependence on others, and language, of course, even if it's a set of games, is a necessarily communal and communicatory game. And there is no possibility of the existence of an individual without relationships and communities. Individualism is indeed central to any liberal, democratic, civilized, or for that matter, Christian understanding of what it is to be human. For the individual is the center of the self, of thought, freedom, love, and all other worthwhile human achievements. And if you wanted a simple demonstration of the relationship of Christianity to individualism, I could simply quote from my confirmation sermons, which are all about you are coming here to fulfill your baptism. Now, baptism is not only in God's name, but in your own, which shows that it's you God wants. I mean, that's a very partial way of putting it, but I'm not against individualism. Of course not. It's this perversion of individualism which is, well, could be the death of us. The type specimen, self-centered individual of the theories of freedom of choice in the free market is a contradiction in terms from the sheer physical and psychological nature of things to the maintenance of a collaborative and worthwhile life-sustaining and communicative network. So there can be no necessity, like the necessity of accepting the universe, in the way markets run and are run at present. Further, there is an urgent necessity to build into market considerations and market decisions some consideration of higher and broader goods than those promoted by competitive self-interest and perpetual growth in profits and consumption. Prudence requires this against such threats as pollution, resource exhaustion, and the increasing instability of comprehensive global financial markets. Moral outrage requires this against the indecencies promoted by the present functionings of our economic systems. We might even say that the combined self-interests of those of us who do not play the markets may also influence us, or at least encourage us into ideological suspicion about these claims of necessity. After all, it is the people who make the most out of playing the markets who tell us most strongly how necessary and inevitable their current forms and processes are. And as Fukuyama comments in his discussion on the struggle for recognition in the end of history and the last man, in the absence of positive higher goods, what usually fulfills the vacuum at the heart of Lockean liberalism is the open-ended pursuit of wealth, now liberated from the traditional restraints of need and scarcity, that is to say, sheer and simple greed. But there is no inexorable need for this. However, how do we rally responses to this so that we may reverse these dangerous, undesirable, and unnecessary things which are going on? Perhaps we should attempt to reconstruct a viable and pragmatic conception of the common good as a set of programs. A set of programs for responding to the obvious indecencies around us and the obviously urgent threats which confront us. I suspect we do not want, but we certainly don't have the time to wait for, any new ideology of the good society. We need some new pragmatic insights into how to tackle the bad society. But these can come, I suspect, only as and if we recover our moral nerve and are prepared to organize in protest, rather than to acquiesce in what we have been trapped into believing is inevitable and irremediable. It is obvious that we must find ways of mitigating poverty rather than increasing it, of counting more people into society rather than leaving them out, and of restraining the excesses of greed and the irresponsibilities of pollution and speculation which make money but waste the world and distort people. We may not be able to agree about a common good which we should pursue, but we can clearly conceive of numerous common pressures to which we must respond. And indeed, there is increasing evidence that more and more people and groups are recognizing indecencies of which we should be ashamed and are longing to find some way of doing something about it and indeed of building up outrage. So we have to cease to be mesmerized by arguments about economic necessity, which are of very doubtful coherence, by an idolatry of purely material growth related merely to the satisfaction of individual consumption, and by the mechanics, processes, and technologies of things. Surely it is more natural and more central and more essential to care for persons. We can therefore revive our moral concerns for persons and for the world and organize to respond to our longings for more human ways of using our resources and to responding to our sense of outrage at so many current indecencies. After all, we have global communication systems, we have global markets, and we have global problems. Why cannot we use our immense technological resources and our latent moral resources to work locally, regionally, and globally to attack badness and to develop the wider possibilities of decent and humane neighborliness? Thank you.
Bishop Jenkins has very kindly agreed to answer one or two questions if anybody wishes to ask any. Please.
Thank you, Bishop Jenkins, for a stimulating talk. I wonder if you could comment on considerable anecdotal evidence, although I'm not a sociologist anymore, but that the welfare state and its necessity for regulation, which ultimately seems to become mind stuff, do not help the people they're designed to help, that is the poor and the privileged subculture, which remains like that, but are increasingly exploited by the better educated and quicker witted middle classes to their own advantage.
Yes, I think that all I can comment at the moment is that's all part of the evidence which has to be taken into account, and underlines a point I was trying to make but didn't make sufficiently, which it isn't, it's no question of going back. This is why I was playing all the time with the question of nostalgia and reviving one's visions. The point about a vision is it's a vision for the future. And it is not an attempt at reviving the past. I mean, I think part of Hayek absolutely says nostalgia is no good and it doesn't work and we are not like that. As a matter of fact, of course, we are. I mean, cavemen are around all the time, but you know. And I think this is very important. This is why, again, one of my trios is logical reflection, rigorous analysis, and visionary approach. You see? But you've got the point, really, of my somewhat performatory exclamations is to say there are these difficulties unquestionably. We have been so, actually I think it's to do with the fact that, as I once told a meeting of the Vaux Club in the House of Commons, the Vaux Group in the House of Commons, all that Mrs. Thatcher did was to stand Marx, he hadn't stood Hegel on his head, she then stood Marx on his head. That is to say, you have one complete theory, which you think works, and then you say it doesn't work, so you have another complete theory. Well, this is nonsense. There ain't no complete theories, just as there ain't no complete world. And there aren't indeed any complete people. Yet. So the whole matter is to take up these analyses very seriously. And I think we shall return to a whole lot of themes, including the business of being very suspicious of the people in power, which includes, of course, us.
Sorry, just one moment.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting out of here.
Please, go on.
Yes.
Lord Bishop.
Oh. Unfortunately, the vision of the absolute good which Plato offered was used as part of Karl Popper's arguments, more or less established, for various forms of fascism, imposition, and tyranny. And I think We don't know what is good enough for us. I would like to say that nothing is good enough for us until the very end of things, when there is either nothing, in which case you stop trying, or there is everything, which is God. Pardon me putting it like that, but I mean, that's the way I would want to put it. There isn't anything that's good enough. This is one of the things that we should recover our understanding of. This is why one has again and again, I think, to tackle what is obviously bad or obviously indecent or obviously deeply disturbing, so that we move forward. And one of the things that I'm wanting to try and argue about is that we have actually, oddly enough in a sense, lost any dynamic sense. I mean, it's like the arguments which I have cut out from the Times but haven't had time to analyse, of various people who are saying, of course, Sir James Goldsmith is totally crazy in worrying about protection and so on. Now, I have a very strong suspicion that he is totally crazy. But the argument which is used against them is that for the last 200 years, the market has delivered so-and-so. Yes, that's the last 200 years. This is a form of historicism, not of being historical. Being historical requires a sense of what's happened so far with a very acute sense of what's happening now and therefore what's likely to happen for the future. Not to say, oh, it's always been like this. I think one of the very few near triumphs that I've ever had was being summoned by the governor of the Bank of England after I delivered a sermon, in a New Year's sermon to the bankers about things can't go on as they are, can they? You see? And he summoned me to talk to his heads of departments as to why they couldn't. But he was bothered. So I'm afraid the absolute good is an invitation. And people will glimpse it in different ways. But the nearest thing I can get for starting one's inquiry into the absolute good is looking in the face of people. I don't think that's sentimental. I think it's an absolutely basic necessity. You see all sorts of things in the face of people. As I won't to say now that I'm in my 70th year when addressing congregations, I'm getting bothered about heaven, because if I'm wrapped up to it with you lot and have to stay for eternity, it'd be more like hell. You know? that is to say, if you look in the face of people, you see all sorts of mixed things. But it's these dimensions which need restoring. And we don't pursue the absolute good, I believe. We have to pursue the absolute demand to be open to other people and possibilities, combined with the whoopee of this, as well as the boo, I think, if I may put it this way. And it's this what needs restoring. And so, hence my attack on, you know, the sheer boredom of things. And the sheer routinization. And the very fact that you should think that health, for instance, or health care should be delivered in packaged commodities, I'm not sure whether it shows you're wicked or dim. I think there was somebody over here who got overruled. Wasn't there somebody who was going to talk when I wasn't talking? Excuse me, Chairman. Yes.
Oh, I beg your pardon, please.
Yeah. Big dams and things. Yes. Well, I think all I can say to that is I think more and more people, including the World Bank and IMF, are getting into proper discussion, though it's very slow, about this sort of thing. I mean, the whole, I always forget without looking up whether it's IMF or World Bank, but the recent meeting of whatever institution it was very stung, wasn't it, by the dossier that had been prepared by Christian Aid and other organizations about almost the irrelevance or the distortion of what they're doing. And the fact that they were so stung and produced a detailed reply shows that this argument is going around. I mean, I had the privilege and fun of several conversations with Schumacher, you know, back in the early days of intermediate technology, and it is clear that there's a whole lot of things there, just as in health service overseas, which I was involved with, it was quite clear that the answer to health problems is not to set up immense technological hospitals, but to get resources out into networks on the ground. There are all sorts of imperatives, including strictly economic ones, which are actually pushing against the bigger and bigger and bigger. and the need to get smaller and smaller and smaller and nearer to people. I think the only one can take the hope that if people go on pressing these things, and above all, if they prepare dossiers which argue them. You know. The point about Christian aid, for instance, is they've got some really very good experts who have worked in the area of international trade and so on, who are combining the evidence. And it just is not the case that multiplication, growth, amalgamation and so on improves efficiency in any way that's worth having.
Would you like to ask a question? I'm afraid this will have to be the last one, please.
For many years, I've been on fire with outrage against the increasing insanity of our society. But how best to do something about it? If one works under an existing organisation, then the message, the feeling of outrage gets slightly altered by the organisation within which one is working. How best to do something about this outrage, the insanity?
That question, again, is being asked more and more widely. I think you have to do a combination of bottling it up and letting it out whenever the opportunity occurs until you build up. So many people respond that the noise level is sufficient to get it heard, if I can put it that way. Only this morning, and it's lucky for you that I decided that this lecture was too long or I'd started quoting it, I got a letter in the post from another charity which has set itself up to rally all sorts of people about this sort of thing. And they've got 2 pages of quotations from all sorts of other people who've said it. We haven't got to a critical mass yet. And also, I think it very important that part of the response to all this must be endurance. If you keep on letting off outrage without it being focused, it dissipates. And I think a lot of, for instance, I've never joined a march, I think, except on one occasion. Well, several to do with the miners and the strike, but that was different. Well, they belong to me and I belong to them, if you see what I mean. It wasn't a purely political gesture. Unless you're very carefully organized with your publicity and backup and so on, people just sort of let off energy instead of having to suffer the enduring business of holding it until it can be channeled and shared.
I think we're all immensely grateful to Dr. Jenkins for this illuminating, invigorating, and unreasonably reasonable discourse. I think we will all go away probably rather better armed with thoughts about how to avoid indecencies, even if we are not quite sure yet what the decencies are which we are trying to find. The one thing which I think will be of particular value to the original members of this seminar is that one or two of them, Dr. Jenkins, who have slipped from the vision of the good society, which a number of us share with you, may now be forced perhaps slightly to re-examine one or two of the thoughts which indecently have crept into their thinking in recent decades. I would like to conclude by thanking you enormously for your logical analysis, for your visionary approach, and for being able just, perhaps unfortunately, to contain your moral indignation. Thank you.